The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in his Washington Times Community column, Forbidden City Talk.
It's time now for The Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you're wondering how Christians can have the gall to call Jesus the only way to God. Isn't that rather close-minded? I mean, even if you could accept the belief in hell, and you have trouble with that belief too, you may be asking, isn't there a difference between believing in a God who sends evil people to hell and a God who condemns us simply because we don't believe in Jesus? Isn't this awfully closed-minded? Well, it's not a theology exam on Judgment Day. It's not about just believing in Jesus. There are a lot of people that believe Jesus exists, and a lot of people believe Jesus was God incarnate who will still be in hell. It's about obeying God and recognizing that left to our own devices without the Spirit of God, we're not doing the things our own conscience says. But let's back up to the idea about being closed-minded. At the beginning of any kind of inquiry, we should certainly be open to a wide range of possibilities. But sooner or later, everybody closes their minds. Let me say that again. Sooner or later, everybody closes their minds. We remain open only for a while with the objective of finding what we are looking for, learning new facts, and then eventually closing our minds once we have the facts. Whether or not the world rotates around the sun may have been an open question millennia ago, but scientists have long, several millennia ago, but scientists have long since drawn their conclusions. A student at UC Santa Barbara once accused me of being closed-minded and insisted that if I had an open mind, I could not possibly believe that there is only one way to God. Now, I got to tell you, I don't quite understand the problem with God coming down to earth saying, "Hi, I'm God, and I, God, am the only way to God." I mean, that actually makes sense when you think about it. But anyway, I said to this guy, I said, "Let me ask you a question." And I don't believe anybody had ever asked him this. I said, "Are you open-minded enough to consider the possibility that there is only one way to God?" He says, "What?" I said, "Well, you say you have an open mind." "All right, then. Are you open-minded enough to at least ponder the possibility that Jesus may be the only way?" "Absolutely not." "Oh, really? Really, this is interesting. You can't even consider it?" "Never." "Well, why can't you?" "Because such a belief is closed-minded." I said, "But the consideration of the belief isn't. An open mind says maybe there are 1,000 ways to God. Maybe there are 2 ways to God. Maybe there are no ways to God. Maybe there are 3.5 ways to God. Or maybe, just maybe, there is one God and there is only one way to this God." Considering all those possibilities is a truly open mind. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show. Our theme, obviously, Christianity, but not just that. Christianity and its relationship to politics and pop culture. Speaking of politics, yes, it's that wonderful time of the election year. The last week, primaries and conventions have long since faded away in the rearview mirror. The lips of candidates are still sore from all the behinds they kissed within their party bases. Now they set out to court those coveted, undecided voters. Generally, those who still have not made up their minds by the last few weeks of the election are unaffiliated with the two major parties. Sometimes they are, but they are commonly dubbed independents. That very title suggests that such a person is a cut above other voters. "I go by the issues, not the party. I'm balanced. I'm nonpartisan." Yes, it always seems refreshing to meet individuals who place themselves outside the compromised political machine. Still, a question begs to be asked. Why does our nation keep rolling over and playing dead for these people? Well, part of the answer is obvious. Politicians need their vote. But it's frightening and uncanny how much power the undecided possess. Think about it. Those who have difficulty making up their minds will determine the fate of our country for the next 4 years at a time when the candidates' positions are so opposite that a battle is going on for the very soul of our nation? Now, to be fair, stop clutching your chest. I'm a fair guy. Look at my face. Look at your radio. Isn't this a face you can trust? I'm a fair, fair guy. And to be fair, many independents are just that, truly independent, okay? Many independents are people frustrated with the hypocrisy that often characterizes both major parties. Many independents study various issues and find themselves sometimes agreeing with Republicans, other times siding with Democrats. Bill O'Reilly of Fox News, I'll give you an honest example. He serves as a good example. Love him or hate him, the man obviously thinks for himself and hammers politicians from both sides of the aisle when he does interviews. O'Reilly sounds like a conservative when talking about the economy. And yet he's against the death penalty. That's a viewpoint shared by many liberals. But while some independents are appropriately analytical, there are other kinds of independents. They're the ones I'm mostly talking about right now, and they are the fickle voters. One has to wonder why they still have not made up their minds at this late stage of the game. It's not as if the differences between today's Democrats and Republicans aren't glaringly apparent. A Grand Canyon lies between the viewpoints of Mitt Romney and Barack Obama, not the least of which is the major question of how much government control we want in our lives and our pocketbooks. People who are still undecided have probably not been paying much attention. That theory becomes vindicated when focus groups, and oh, how I love focus groups, when focus groups view debates from special rooms hooked up with the latest electronic gadgets that register their disapproval when one candidate raises his voice too much and another frowns a lot. Afterwards, we're treated to their post-debate comments about who connected more with the audience or who looked most presidential. Meanwhile, other voters watching it all on television look upon these town hall gatherings with amazement. Already strong in their convictions, they just don't care who generated the warmest fuzzy in a town hall meeting. Instead, they choose the candidate who aligns with their own standards and who will deliver his promises, even if for no other reason than pressure from his party and constituents. The affiliations, the promises to special interest groups tell us far more about what will highlight a president's term than his sense of humor or Kodak moment on stage with the wife and kids. If undecided voters became more educated and less pampered, the power of an election would no longer rest in the hands of indifference or postponed dubious decisions. Our present situation is unfair to the many people who seriously study issues and work tirelessly within their parties. Such people often donate time, money, energy, only to see the election held hostage by a small number of uninformed swing voters tossed back and forth by the wind. Now, please understand. Please, I don't want you to get me wrong. There's nothing wrong with people who do not follow politics. One can be uninformed about politics and be very knowledgeable about other subjects. Math, science, computers, archaeology, art, the list is endless. Many choose not to follow politics, on the other hand, because they find our current situation depressing. Well, it is depressing, so who can blame them? Others are simply too busy for politics. They work long hours, providing for their families, coaching Little League, driving their kids to Girl Scout meetings. So I get that. I understand that. I sympathize with that. But whatever the reasons, people who are not following politics should admit it and not vote. Yes, you heard me correctly. Listen carefully. People who are not following politics, that's fine. That's fine. That's fine. But admit it and don't vote. Because if you don't know what you're voting about, you don't have a right. And I know that sounds terrible. Doesn't that just get you right here? I am not a big believer in getting out the vote. Voting may be a right, but the right is too sacred to abuse. American citizens also have a right to become doctors if they want, if they so desire, but not everybody is allowed to perform surgery. Somebody wants to perform surgery, what does our society do? We insist that a potential doctor study hard for many years and eventually graduate medical school. Now, does that sound like an extreme example? Yes, but perhaps the voting situation would look just as grave if we weren't used to it. The notion of encouraging everybody to vote, even the uninformed, is a familiar time-honored tradition. It's become comfortable old leather. I say that if we were to back up and honestly assess the situation, it may just seem insane that the leader of our free world, at a time when terrorists are building nuclear weapons and the world economy threatens and collapse, would be chosen by people based upon a good vibe or a charismatic speech. The day will never come when we force people to take a political science or current events test before voting. So to some degree, we must face reality and consign ourselves to the fact that our country will always have this problem. But maybe we can at least practice some kind of damage control. A good start would be to allow decided voters to ask town hall questions. Then Obama might have to deal honestly with Bill Ayers or the Illinois Infant Protection Act. And to be fair, Romney would also be challenged. He'd have to do a better job of explaining the difference between state and federal intrusion into health care. He'd also be grilled about changing his position on abortion. Instead, we're more likely to hear personal stories about Aunt Sally, who isn't able to pay her rent, or Grandpa Bud needing a hip replacement. It's not hard for candidates to respond to those stories with empathy. They can explain how their policies are the most compassionate. They can blather on for hours after that. One candidate might even shed a tear and win the debate for sure. I remember years ago listening to a woman explain to me why she was not going to vote for George H.W. Bush as president. And the reason was it was because of his running mate, Dan Quayle. Because there's no way I'm voting for him. He can't even spell the word potato. Now, mind you, this woman knew nothing about what was going on in the country and would have been unable to explain the philosophical difference between a Democrat or a Republican. The only thing she knew about this election, and I mean the only thing she knew about this election, was that Quayle couldn't spell the word potato. Dan Quayle supposedly was too stupid for the Oval Office, even though he graduated law school, served in the National Guard, served as a U.S. Senator. The very idea of somebody voting in any election based upon that kind of reasoning, yet smugly patting herself on the back saying he's too stupid for my vote, creates a story scarier than anything Rod Serling could ever have narrated. And yet, such people are wooed by presidential hopefuls. It is time to reevaluate those coveted independents. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
Hey, this is Lori K. Lewis, a frequent co-host on The Bob Siegel Show, Talk Radio 1170 on KCBQ. If you have questions or comments during this radio broadcast, please call Bob at this toll-free number, 1-888-344-1170. Again, the number is 1-888-344-1170. We'd like to hear what you have to say.
Welcome back to our program. Justin Slagle is a theater teacher at Tri-City Christian School. He's also running for the El Cajon Valley School Board. Justin, welcome to our program.
Hey, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Good. So tell us, what is your? How many other people are running against you on the school board?
Well, there are five candidates for two open seats. The two incumbents are both liberal Democrats with teacher union endorsements, and we're doing our best to try to educate the voters and try to flip the board to be conservative for the first time in about 20 years.
Okay. So concisely, what would you say people are going to get with you that they're not getting with the others regarding the unions?
Absolutely. I think in this time especially, at the school board level with our children, with everything else, we're in a day and age where we're in our schools having to answer a lot of questions. What does a family unit look like? We're dealing with SB 48 and that mandate with our textbooks with homosexuality.
Interesting point, because that's already passed from Sacramento. So I think this would be very interesting to our listeners. What would a school board be able to do that? If they get a directive from Sacramento, what can they do to deflect some of that?
Absolutely. It is passed. It was signed into law on July 14th, and it's something they're saying over the next few years, by 2015, these textbooks should start appearing. But there's two or three things to really know. One, it's an unfunded mandate. We're talking left and right about where's the money for education, and you have a governor supporting a tax increase that may or may not go to education, going around threatening teachers, threatening schools, if you don't pass this, I'll cut it some more. And yet you're telling all the schools and all these districts, you have to do this, you have to have these textbooks, but we're not going to help you pay for it. So that's the first issue. It's an unfunded mandate. And they're going to
That could end up being a good thing. If it's unfunded, maybe it can't get implemented as quickly.
Yeah, well, it's a great thing, because they're going to have that legal conversation with the state to say, hey, you're telling us to do this. Where's this money going to come from?
And now, there are also a couple of issues on the ballot that I know you're concerned about. I know that one of them has to do with unions. Tell us about both of them.
Well, Proposition 32 is yes on 32 is the way to go. It's just evening the playing field. The teachers' union has been able to spend hot and heavily, kind of against me and some of the other conservative school board people running for school board, and it's really an unfair system. If you pull the records in California, the CTA, the California Teachers Association, is one of if not the top spending political action committee throughout the state, all over. And they're spending our money on things that have nothing to do with education.
Now, is this the same one? I know that one of them has to do with, wasn't there one about money that's paid as union dues go into campaigns?
That is Prop 32.
Okay.
And so what it does is, for instance, here in San Diego, we have the Lincoln Club of San Diego. It's a pro-business political action committee. I've been endorsed by them. They endorse pro-business, pro-prosperity, low-tax candidates. But for somebody to give their money to the Lincoln Club of San Diego, if any of these businessmen want to donate to this cause, they have to make a choice to write a check, turn it over, and then the Lincoln Club can use that money to support candidates how they choose. Whereas the unions can automatically deduct that money from your payroll, from your check, put it into the union coffers, and spend it on whatever they want without the approval.
Well, unions have certainly taken on a life of their own. Now, what's the other proposition, Justin?
Well, there's two more. There's Prop 30 and there's
two
Prop
more. Jumping Jiminy. I thought there was three of these suckers. Okay. What are the other?
There's Prop 30, Prop 38, and those are both being shrouded here in California as pro-education taxes for education. This is money that's going to go to the schools. But if you actually read the language in the legislation, especially with Prop 30, it's money that does nothing more than go into the general fund that may or may not be used in the schools. And studies show time and time again that education does not improve with increased spending. And so I'm the only candidate that has come out openly to oppose tax increases. I oppose Prop 30 and Prop 38, not because I don't like schools or don't like children. That's a false choice. I'm a teacher myself. But that's not the issue. The issue is how are we spending the money that we have, and not continually taxing the people of California to do nothing more than send their money to the bureaucrats and to the unions.
Okay, and the other one?
Prop 38, which is on the same line. They're both tax increases that will raise Prop 30 will raise the income tax on high earners, as well as it will raise the sales tax. And Prop 38 will raise taxes on.
Okay, go ahead and repeat all three propositions again. They're numbers. So
Prop 30, Prop 32, and Prop 38.
Now, just to give the other side, I've heard that, I don't remember which one, but with one of these, won't the teachers be out of, won't there be a couple of weeks that'll go by where the teachers will have to go without pay?
Well, that's what they are saying. That they're saying. So Governor Brown is showing up to all the schools, and he is holding the teachers and holding education hostage. He says, if you don't pass this tax, we'll cut from education. Now, what they don't say is yes, education will be cut in the budget as it looks now, but it will still be funded more than it was last year. They don't tell us that. But the second thing is, it is a choice to cut from education. You can cut from anywhere, yet they're choosing to cut from education.
Oh, so you think they're exploiting the education system?
They are holding our schools, they are holding our teachers, and they're holding our children's hostage to get us, who already pay the highest sales tax in the nation, to get us to pay even more taxes.
Okay, well, Justin, if you win the election, we'll have you back sometime and for a longer period of time, and we'll let you talk about how it's all going. Why don't you give out your website for now?
Very good. www.justinslagle.com. And then you can look me up on Facebook on facebook.com/electSlagle.
Okay, Justin Slagle, El Cajon Valley School Board. Thanks, Justin.
Thank you, Bob.
Okay, you're listening to the Bob Siegel Show. We will be right back. This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539. W&S Electric.
We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Welcome back. I don't usually bring people running for local politics on the show. As you probably notice, I stress national politics much more. And I'm not saying local politics aren't important. Of course, they're very important. It's where you live. And I do have a lot of friends that are involved with local politics. And I'm glad Justin was able to come on and have some time. The reason I stress a national, just a personal thing, I honestly, if we don't get this guy out of the White House with the agenda that he has another 4 years, it could so change the landscape of our country that it just ain't going to matter who's on the school board anymore. So that's the method to my madness. But I was happy to have Justin Slagle on, if only for a few minutes. Now, earlier in our program, I mentioned that I don't blame those who hate talking about any politics, national or local. They find the subject depressing. Well, I'm going to tell you, that includes me. Now, I know I've said that before. You probably didn't believe me then. You probably don't believe me now, but it's true. I find politics depressing. I enjoy doing our Bible emphasis shows so much more. And even when in regular life, off the radio, I move on to other subjects, secular subjects, politics is not my passion. My passion is writing. And yes, these past few years, most of my writing has been for a lot of nonfiction columns for internet news magazines. But what I love writing is fiction. I love writing plays. I love writing novels. Right now, a children's novel that I wrote about a magic Christmas ornament is being looked at by a publisher. They have shown me some interest, but I don't know what their final decision will be. I know this. If they decided to publish it, it would be a dream come true. And if I wrote more books like that for the rest of my life, I'd be happy if I never wrote about or ever discussed politics again. But that won't happen. That won't happen even if the book is published, and I'll tell you why. Because in life, we sometimes have a calling that goes beyond our personal dreams. If you were living in Nazi Germany, it wouldn't have mattered if you enjoyed writing children's novels. Now, am I comparing our country to Nazi Germany? No, of course not. But I'll tell you what I am doing. I'm comparing our country to the weak, Weimar Republic, which crumbled and became Nazi Germany, because there are many comparisons you can draw there. Sometimes we have to take our heads out of the sand and realize that something more important than our own personal lives is going on. For example, by now, you should know of the chilling new facts which were unveiled on Friday regarding the September destruction in Benghazi. They were broken by Fox News. I'm going to read a little bit from Fox News. Fox News has learned from sources who were on the ground at Benghazi that an urgent request from CIA annex for military backup during the attack in the U.S. consulate and subsequent attack several hours later on the annex itself was denied by the CIA chain of command, who also told the CIA operators twice to stand down rather than help the ambassador's team when shots were heard at approximately 9:40 p.m. This was in Libya. It's almost unimaginable that the Obama administration could spin their way out of this one. They'll try saying something, but there aren't too many cards left to play. The video narrative has ridden off into the horizon and can help them no longer. Possibly they'll point fingers at Fox News as a right-wing and therefore unreliable source. They'd be wise not to try it. A quick trip down memory lane takes us back to September when DNC chairwoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz claimed the conservative Washington Examiner misquoted her, only to discover that her words had been recorded. Even if Debbie had not already paved the way to fool's gold, Obama should remember that conservative news outlets are not alone in this ever-morphing story. His allies in the mainstream media cannot shield him forever. Sometimes when evidence pours down like sharp, cold hail, conventional news outlets actually report the news. It might come as a whole new experience for them, but they do it if only by kicking and screaming. Just 2 days ago, CNN published the following. 2 hours after the attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, the White House, the State Department, and the FBI were told that an Islamist group had claimed credit government emails obtained by the CNN show. One of the emails sent from a State Department address to various government agencies specifically identifies Ansar al-Sharia as claiming responsibility for the attack on its Facebook page and on Twitter. The emails raise further questions about the seeming confusion on the part of the Obama administration to determine the nature of the September attack and those who planned it. The attack left U.S. Ambassador Christopher Stevens and 3 other Americans dead. Now, I was just reading from CNN. That wasn't Fox. That was CNN. That was an earlier development in the story. Fox got the latest scoop. But this more recent story about a command to stand down may be the most potent revelation of all. People are stretching their imaginations to figure out why help could be denied in the face of death. Even before this latest Fox report, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta tried some damage control in a press conference. He said, you don't deploy forces into harm's way without knowing what's going on. We felt we could not put forces at risk in that situation. Then he went on, he said, it was really over before we had the opportunity to really know what was happening. Okay, now do those comments add up with the scrutiny of Friday's breaking news? However, that question is answered. We are forced to believe the Obama administration was being somewhat less than truthful in its claim that the Benghazi attack was spontaneous violence resulting from an anti-Muslim YouTube video. Over a month ago, White House Press Secretary Jay Carney said, and I'm quoting him, "This is not a case of protests directed at the United States writ large or at U.S. policy. This is in response to a video that is offensive." Now, press secretaries say what they are told to say. You know that. I know that. Everybody knows that. Carney may have believed it, or he may have known it was a lie and chose to go along. Either way, he repeated the official Obama narrative. If President Obama knew the truth and told Carney to lie, he has lost the right to be president. The only other explanation is that somehow these reports never got to him, possibly because he was busy campaigning, possibly for some other reason. To believe that, we'd have to imagine a scenario where our president's subordinates were deliberately keeping him in the dark. Now, anything is possible, but it's easier to believe Santa and Mrs. Claus are giving up Christmas and retiring to Bermuda. For some Obama supporters, the breakdown in information theory may sound more palatable, but the choice would be gross negligence as opposed to downright lying. Even so, a portion of the lie would still remain. Supposing we choose to defy the laws of logic, and that's what we'd have to do. Supposing we chose to defy the laws of logic and assume that despite cries from help, emails, and official intelligence reports, Obama still did not know the truth. We are left asking where the video story came from. If he didn't know anything, how was he so sure he knew that? It's been alleged that early intelligence did offer a video explanation, but this seems less and less likely as more news comes out. Now, true, there were riots going on in a lot of countries at our consulates and embassies. A case can be made that some of them were about that video or perhaps terrorists exploiting the video. But we now know Benghazi was completely unrelated. The most likely explanation is that facts are stubborn little critters in the face of an election year. They come when least expected and often ruin a campaign slogan such as Osama bin Laden is dead. Obama wanted the country to believe that the death of a terrorist figurehead somehow meant that the war on terror was in significant decline. As Muslim riots visited one American embassy after another on the anniversary of 9/11, Obama's optimism came crashing down hard enough to be seen even by those who are naive about Islamic extremism. Apparently, the war on terror is alive and kicking, an inconvenient truth, if I might quote Al Gore out of context. It's an inconvenient truth. It's an inconvenient truth. Perhaps the video narrative worked better for Obama's campaign until the real truth ruined everything by climbing out of the rubble. Now, we can't read minds. No matter what information comes out, no matter how much Congress grills this administration before or after the election, it is doubtful that we will hear anyone say in so many words, we covered this up for the sake of winning re-election. Neither will we see Obama apologize to Romney for accusing the governor of exploiting Benghazi to make political points. I do not believe we will ever read a headline saying Obama admits to being the greatest hypocrite of the century. No, we won't see that in any paper, mainstream or new media. But I got to tell you, if a dealer in Las Vegas knew the truth and asked us to make a bet, I'd know which odds to take. Hint, the money would not be with the candidate who campaigned in Vegas the day of the Benghazi attack. Well, the debates are over. We had one almost a week ago, last Monday, and we had another one the week before. Now, I did write columns about each of them, but with my radio show being on only once a week and with so much news accelerating around us, it's hard to catch up. So let me start with the more recent debate, since it's still the one fresh in your minds. And then, if we have time, I would also like to discuss that incredibly stupid town hall debate with Candy Crawley, because a travesty took place that evening. But first, last week's Bob Schaefer travesty. And we'll do the Bob Schaefer travesty when we return to the Bob Siegel Show. To build your own website without a lot of cost and trouble? Hi, I'm Bob Siegel, here to tell you about Web Studio. Web Studio allows people to create their own websites simply and easily without knowing HTML. With Web Studio, you avoid the learning curve of front page and the expense of a web designer. Web Studio has 14 different galleries that contain graphics, sounds, and everything else you need. For more information about Web Studio, go to webstudio.com.
When the truth is found to be lies, and all the joy within you dies, don't you want somebody to love? Don't you need somebody to love? Wouldn't you love somebody to love? You better find.
Welcome back to KCBQ. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. All right, nobody likes a Monday morning quarterback. But inasmuch as President Obama and Governor Romney faced each other for the final time last Monday night, and since both my column and today's radio show monologue were deliberately postponed, in order to benefit from longer reflection. The worst I can be called is a one-week-later quarterback. Monday's miserable excuse for a debate continues to be analyzed by news pundits and political experts, all eager to unveil their own personal theories as to why the evening offered such a dismal show. The verdict is still out. The only thing we know for sure is that 90 minutes were sliced out of our lives. There's an hour and a half we'll never have back again. The time would have been better spent watching Channel 13 show a documentary on how to assemble a flashlight. Now, admittedly, a few tasty morsels surfaced that evening at Lynn University, but the remainder of the meal was worse than a liver and asparagus sandwich. Obama behaved like Obama, full of accusations about his opponent, hoping to run out the clock so that his own lies would stay in the shadows, robbing Romney of any chance to highlight two or three of them, or 40 or 50 of them. Interruptions and mocking smiles from the president reminded us of the recent vice presidential debate. Oh yeah, Obama still managed enough restraint to come across as less goofy than Joe Biden, but the bar wasn't too high for that. Goofy himself is less goofy than Joe Biden because Disney cartoons are held to actual standard. Oh, well, I'm goofy. As it happens, Obama's Oscar-caliber performance proved unnecessary. Who could have predicted that Romney would disappoint his supporters by coming across like a boxer paid to take a dive? On the other hand, CBS News journalist Bob Schaefer disappointed no one. You see, to be disappointed, we would have had to have expected something better. His contribution demonstrated sad predictability. If tired talking points, dodged questions, and fact-challenged responses have become commonplace for abusive politicians, then these journalists, moderators, do the enabling. In a real debate, moderators are not allowed to set the agenda. Instead, participants make the case they wish to make and ask their opponents hard questions of their own choosing. They are not obligated to the moderator's opinion of what should or should not be discussed. The Bob Schaefers of the world must no longer be allowed to move on to a new subject simply because they think it's important. We already have shows like 60 Minutes and Meet the Press for that sort of thing. Schaefer's priorities notwithstanding, new information, as you heard in our last segment, is surfacing every day regarding the whole terrorist fiasco in Libya, its lack of security, despite numerous warnings and its consequent cover-up. Important concerns call both the integrity and competency of our current president into question. Obama should have been grilled on Monday night until he offered a real answer, and Romney should have done the grilling, especially since he began such an interrogation in the last debate, only to have his battery pulled out by another fun moderator. So what happens in debate three? After a very brief general discussion of Libya, Schaefer decides it's time to move on to other countries. And yet later in the evening, when Obama finishes his allotted time only to interrupt nonstop during Romney's turn, Schaefer does nothing. Now, I know, interruptions are usually unavoidable to some degree. And certainly Romney interrupted a few times himself, but during one frustrating section, that guy could barely utter a syllable without Obama cutting him off. At this point, we actually did need Schaefer. It was his chance to finally do one of the few things a moderator is supposed to do. He had a chance to be a real moderator. He failed miserably. Still, Schaefer's contribution pales in comparison to Romney's muzzling himself in ways even DreamWorks could not have imagined. Now, initially, many conservative commentators gave Romney a mixed review. Oh, they loved how Romney nailed Obama regarding that magical mystery apology tour. Despite the tired technical talking point that Obama never actually used the word apology. I know he didn't use the word apology. He was being overly critical of America overseas, but no, the word apology wasn't there, okay? It was still an apology tour. But then these same pundits who liked seeing Romney grill Obama about that were also frustrated when Romney remained conspicuously silent about Libya. Later, as the days wore on and the dust settled, I noticed that a lot of conservative opinions were starting to reassess Romney's performance, maybe taking their cues from Fox News analyst Charles Krauthammer, who was happy with Romney even within the first few minutes following the debate. Krauthammer suggested that Romney, far from making mistakes, was instead operating under a clever strategy. Here are his words. He said, Romney went large. Obama went very, very small, shockingly small. Romney made a strategic decision not to go after the president on Libya or Syria or other areas where Obama could accuse him of being a Bush-like warmonger. Now, I would have gone after Obama on Libya with a baseball bat, but that's why Romney has won elections, and I have never even contested them. Okay, those are the words of Charles Krauthammer. Krauthammer may be onto something. As a matter of fact, Romney could have been accused of many things by Obama, not merely being a warmonger. Without doubt, Obama was ready. Oh, he was ready for this. Anyone who watched the last debate knew he'd have to be ready. It would be a canned, rehearsed answer, but he was ready to assume the controversial Libya discussion. As a matter of fact, had Romney raised the matter, we would have heard from Obama some rehearsed speech about how the matter is being investigated, and due to national security concerns, nothing more can be said at the present time, at least not until after the election. Then he would have gone on to remind everybody again how appalling it is for Romney to exploit a tragedy for political gain. Now, perhaps Romney caught Obama off guard by not even going there, figuring the whole matter was unraveling more and more every day anyway and needed no more challenge from him. Besides, focus groups disliked the confrontational counterpunching of debate, too. Now, maybe Romney kept that in mind, and maybe Romney outsmarted us all. Whatever the strategy, Monday's debate did not seem to hurt him in the polls. Hopefully, Romney was being strategically brilliant. Hopefully, he'll still win the election. So why do I still have a problem with this whole thing? The problem is that for the moment, Obama gets another in his unending series of free passes. True, the Libya issue seems to be on a road without any turns and will soon completely implode. In the meantime, it's still painful to watch a man getting away with disingenuous blathering. Now, let me say how refreshing it would have been to hear Governor Romney say something like, Mr. President, during the last debate, you insisted that you did not call the attack in Libya a terrorist act. Did you mean that you did call the attack in Libya a terrorist act? Did you mean a coordinated attack as opposed to an out-of-control uprising? If not, your point was irrelevant. If so, why did we continue to hear about a video for a couple of weeks? Why did Jake Carney push this story at a press conference? Why did Ambassador Susan Rice go on 5 Sunday morning talk shows saying the same thing? Or here's another question he could have asked. Mr. President, you responded to my point about skipping Israel on your trip to the Middle East by reminding me that you visited Israel and the Holocaust Museum in 2008. Mr. President, isn't there a difference between visiting Israel as a candidate and visiting Israel as President of the United States? As President, you have not been to Israel, and when Prime Minister Netanyahu came to the recent United Nations meeting, you were too busy to see him, even though you made time to be on The View. As for the Holocaust Museum, I'm glad you are concerned about the Holocaust, Mr. President, but that makes me wonder why you were willing to meet with an actual Holocaust denier, Iranian President Ahmadinejad, without preconditions. In 2008, in that Democratic debate, you were asked point blank if you would meet with the leaders of Iran without preconditions. You said, I would. Now, those are mere examples of many questions that could have been asked.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's weekly column for Washington Times Communities. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net, S-I-E-G-E-L, bobsiegel.net. Here, you can download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Welcome back to our program. As I was saying, I would have liked to have seen Romney grill Obama more. Even though people are saying he used a lot of strategy, didn't go where Obama wanted to go, that may be. But it would be nice, so nice, to not see President Obama get away in 2012 with stuff he got away with in 2008. In 2008, he was elected despite his vote against the Illinois Infant Protection Act, his history with a self-professed terrorist, Bill Ayers, his 20-year attendance at Trinity United Church, where Reverend Jeremiah Wright spewed out just the worst hatred. He screamed out words such as, "God, you know what, America." While talk radio and Fox News stayed on top of such matters in 08, the mainstream media gave them only a microscopic amount of attention, and that was usually after someone else broke the story. Even Obama's rival, John McCain, was reluctant to take off the gloves. Let me tell you something. If Mitt Romney wins this election, watch for allegations of election fraud. Watch also for a parallel attack. Liberal commentators will insist that racism was the only possible reason Obama could have lost supporters this time around. Now, mind you, they won't be able to explain why people who voted for Obama in 2008 but not 2012 suddenly became racist any more than they can process conservative African Americans who voted for McCain in 08, ignoring Obama's skin color while paying attention to Obama's platform. And so regardless of who wins, the national discussion is going to be going on for quite some time. That is why Obama's character needs to be confronted. Even if he loses, it needs to be confronted. Even when such a strategy suggests that at the moment to win the election, confrontation is not immediately necessary, this guy needs to be confronted, finally, by somebody. Had Romney done so, with or without Schaefer's permission, it would have at least created a better debate, maybe even a real debate. And then there was that town hall debate 2 weeks ago. Now, some of my frustrations were the same with that one, but that one just threw the internet and the media into a tizzy. People are still arguing over the definition of the word terror. The question should be easy to settle. In fact, the argument might have been over by now had there also been an honest definition of another important word, moderator. The more interesting story there began before that Tuesday evening when both presidential candidates made an attempt to moderate the moderator with a written agreement. And here was the written agreement. The moderator will not ask follow-up questions or comment on either the questions asked by the audience or the answers of the candidates during the debate or otherwise intervene in the debate except to acknowledge the questioners from the audience or enforce the time limits and invite candidate comments during the two-minute response period. All right, well, an interview with Political offered some rather obvious clues that Crowley was not taking that agreement very seriously. Candy Crowley said, "I'm not a fly on the wall. I'm going to react organically to what's happening." Well, Romney and Obama still showed up, even though she pretty much told them she wasn't going to follow the rules. So they showed up. They have to live with their decision. The fate is more palatable for Obama. Although the requested rules came from both candidates, our president is quite happy Crowley refused to comply. After hearing her authenticate his claim that he did initially call the Libyan attack on September 11th terror, Obama looked like a satisfied Jeopardy contestant listening to Alex Trebek declare, "That is correct." Maybe Obama didn't phrase his answer as a question, but plenty of questions were hatched as a result of Crowley's interference. Now, as you know, a lot of critical news has been reported since then. We talked about some of it earlier in the show. But even before that development, there were other crucial facts uncovered by a House investigation. And during the debate, Romney, relying on already established news, said, and I quote, "And there was no demonstration involved. It was a terrorist attack, and it took a long time for that to be told to the American people. Whether there was some misleading or instead whether we just didn't know what happened, you have to ask yourself, why didn't we know 5 days later when the ambassador to the United Nations went on TV to say that this was a demonstration? How could we have not known?" Well, his words were rebuked by Obama. A sparring match followed, culminating in Candy Crowley's now infamous verdict. And I'm just reading it. She said this a little faster, but on the transcript it goes, it. Yes, she said that three times. It. He did, in fact, sir. So let me call it an act of terror. Well, Obama was so delighted, he asked her to repeat the statement. It was like, hang on, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire being thrown a lifeline. Many members of the audience shared his enthusiasm. They clapped. Clapping was also a violation of the rules. Didn't matter. Since perception gets mistaken for reality, Obama was informally viewed by many as the winner. Now, according to the FBI Code of Federal Regulations, here's the definition of terrorism. FBI Code. The unlawful use of force and violence against persons or property to intimidate or coerce a government, the civilian population, or any segment thereof in furtherance of political or social objectives. Now, that may be the official definition, but some people use the term far more loosely, far more generally. They view any act of violence or vandalism as terror. Now, such common generic usage suggests that two people can use the same word and mean different things. Romney was talking about a coordinated attack by an actual terrorist organization timed with the anniversary of 9/11 and 2001 World Trade Center destruction. Obama's actual words at the Rose Garden speech seemed to use the word terror in the looser definition. He said, no acts of terror will ever shake the resolve of the great nation. He wasn't even talking about Libya at that moment of the speech. He was talking in general. It won't shake the nation, alter the character, or eclipse the light of the values that we stand for. That's what Obama said. Now, multiple definitions offer convenient cover-up when people are caught contradicting themselves. When first accused, President Bill Clinton insisted he did not have sex with intern Monica Lewinsky, only to later discover that she had a stained dress as evidence. His subsequent pseudo-confession strained the definition of sex. Here were his exact words. He said, "While my answers were legally accurate, I did not volunteer information. Indeed, I did have a relationship with Miss Lewinsky that was not appropriate. In fact, it was wrong." Okay, those were the words of Bill Clinton. The key words are here is that he said his first answer in court, where he was charged with perjury, was legally correct. You see, evidently, oral sex is not supposed to pass as real, honest, goodness sex. And so, in Clintonian fashion, the true meaning of the word terror is now also being parsed. Since Romney was talking about terror in the vein of Al-Qaeda or similar groups, Obama is disingenuous to act as if his Rose Garden speech intended that same definition. If such was the case, why did his surrogates emphasize alleged spontaneous violence in response to an offensive video after the Rose Garden talk? After the Rose Garden talk, they said that. But we don't even need to go that far back to settle this. Candy Crowley herself appeared on CNN panel that same night of the debate and explained that Romney was right. Inasmuch as Obama and his spokespeople still insisted for weeks the incident was about a video. Here were her words on the panel. She said, "Right after that, I did turn around and say, but you're totally correct that they spent 2 weeks telling us this was about a tape and that there was this riot outside the Benghazi consulate, which there wasn't. He was right in the main. I just think he picked the wrong word." Well, now, unfortunately, most people will never see her post-debate elaboration. Instead, what do they remember? A feisty, confrontational moment where the moderator acted as a referee. Now, although Crowley offered a qualifying statement during the critical debate moment, she said it incorrectly. With the CNN panel, Crowley was not actually repeating what she was said. She was repeating what she thought she had said. But I have the transcript in front of me. Her actual words were, he did call it an act of terror. It did as well take 2 weeks or so for the whole idea there being a riot out there about this tape to come out. You are correct about that, Candy Crowley's words. Well, it did not take 2 weeks for them to get out the idea about the riot being a result of the video. They talked about the video immediately. It took 2 weeks for them to admit it was actually a planned terrorist attack. Now, I want to be fair. God knows I make enough gaffes. Crowley didn't intentionally say the reverse of the truth. It was a slip of the tongue. Still, within less than a minute, her sizzling commentary on Libya was Obama 2, Romney 0. Since then, Crowley has explained herself even further. On CNN, she said, "I wasn't trying to get them to clap. I was trying to sort of, you know, bring some kind of clarity to the conversation." Well, thanks for the explanation, Candy. But the real problem was assuming the subject was yours to steer in the first place. You couldn't have picked a finer moment to move along. Two candidates for president are relaying opposite information. One is lying. One is telling the truth. The audience had a right to see the conversation to fruition without you pulling the plug. But Candy was certainly correct about one thing. She was not a fly on the wall. After all, if she had been, the audience might have seen a real debate with an objective moderator who is there to watch the time, keep the candidates from interrupting each other, and keep her opinions to herself. Instead, we witnessed a quiz show where President Obama won the grand prize and Mitt Romney was awarded some lovely parting gifts. And I'm going to part with you and see you next week. That's your gift. Your parting gift is you'll see me next week.
Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.